Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's currently the 8th of December 2014 here in Japan, but we are talking across the dateline where it's the 7th of December to Field McConnell of AbleDanger.net. And I would generally start with an introduction to my guest, but I think given the number of emails I've received from various listeners asking me to have Field on the program, I'm sure a lot of you are already familiar with this name and with the idea of Boeing uninterruptible autopilot that has been talked about in relation to such events as MH370 in recent months and recent years. And for those who are not familiar, of course, you can go to abledanger.net for more information. But Field McConnell, thank you for joining us today on the program.
Well, it's my pleasure and it's my honor. And also, James, I believe it's my obligation because as much as I wish I didn't know a lot of this information, I do know it. And my choice is to be quiet or to expose it. So I've chosen to expose as much truthful information as I possibly can. So thank you very much for allowing me this outlet.
Well, I'm excited to have you here because, as I say, I have been contacted by quite a number of people asking you to have asking me to have you on the program. But let's start. I do, of course, want to get into the story of the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot. But before we do so, perhaps we can get a little bit about your biographical background and the bona fides of how you know this information.
Certainly. And the easiest way for your listeners who are unfamiliar with me to get as much detail as they may wish is to go to our website, which is spelt differently than Able Danger, the Army outfit, which Bill Clinton took down. Our Able Danger is ABELDANGER.net. And there is a bio there. And I'm not trying to be coy. I will give you as much as a bio as you can stand, and then you can cut me off and say that's enough. But I was born of two World War II vets, a U.S. Army nurse who nursed my father back to his health when he returned from Japan, where he was a POW of the Japanese. And there's a movie coming out on Christmas Day. It's called Unbroken. It's about an Olympic miler named Louis Zamperini, who just recently died at age 96 or 97, and he was supposed to be the Grand Marshal of the Rose Bowl parade this year, but unfortunately he is no longer with us. But the reason I bring that up is because my father and Louis Zamperini both crashed into the ocean in similar aircraft under similar conditions, although not exactly the same. But in both cases, a majority of the men on the aircraft were lost. In Louis Zamperini's case, they had 10 men on the B-24, and the malady was that the number 3 engine, I believe it was, quit, and they couldn't feather it. So they had an airplane that was notoriously bent, and airplanes that are bent don't fly efficiently. So they only use that bomber for patrol missions as opposed to bombing missions. But anyway, Lewis was one of three people that got out of the 10-man crew. The others perished in the crash. Of the three that got out, two of them survived till the 47th day in a raft. One of them died before the 47th day when they were rescued, and they were the people in Lewis's airplane were briefly on Kwajalein or Wake or one of those islands that I've been to when I was a Marine Corps C-130 transport pilot, and that doesn't matter. But Louis Zamperini was saved, and his story is well worth reading. The book that he wrote is Devil at My Heels. But he and my father came together at Ofuna, O-F-U-N-A, prison camp in Japan. And they met each other briefly, but once the Japanese host figured out the PR value of Louis Zamperini, since he'd been an Olympic miler in the 1936 Berlin, I think it was, Olympics, they sent him to a more plush camp, and they left my dad with all the other low rents. But my dad survived. My mom nursed him in his health. The event my dad survived was a crash into the ocean as three Japanese fighters had shot out both his number 3 and number 4 engine. And so his choice was to hang around airborne with an airplane that wasn't flying well and get shot down for sure, because the Japanese fighter pilots had already proven to his satisfaction that they were excellent marksmen. So my dad decided to ditch the airplane. He was only a 20-year-old kid, and he was the aircraft commander. So when he attempted to ditch the airplane, he dragged or drug, whichever the proper English is. And by the way, many of the people that have recommended you to me have said that you really have great command of the English language. And I wish more Americans and more English people and Anglophones could speak English better. It's really a lovely language if you understand it. My father decided to ditch. In the ditching maneuver, he dragged a wingtip and the airplane cartwheeled. And out of the 12 men on board, 8 were killed in the impact or drowned, and 4 got out. And what my father's aircraft had been attacking was a Japanese merchant vessel. And the Japanese merchantmen on the vessel came over to pick them up in the water. But 2 of the surviving Americans were shot by small arms while they were in the water. And my father, who grew up in California, which is another similarity to Ernest Zamperini, they're both Los Angeles high school kids. My father was very good in the water, and he stayed underwater as much as he possibly could. And he ended up surviving, spending 16 months in prison camp where he met my mother. They got married 2 weeks later. They were married very happily for 62 years, and they had 2 children. And this is the absolutely perfect time to ask you a question. Are you aware of who my sister is, James?
I am not. You'll have to reveal that.
I will. Her name is Christine Marcy, and I'll spell that. It's K-R-I-S-T-I-N-E. And for your listeners who don't know anything about my sister or myself, if you Google Christine Marcy plus Field McConnell, and for the people that don't recognize my name, it's F-I-E-L-D, M-C-C-O-N-N-E-L-L. My parents, both veterans, both patriotic people, and both believers in a faith system, had 2 children, and we couldn't be more opposite if we were named Hatfield and McCoy, because my sister is part of the shadow government, and she is one of the biggest parts of the shadow government, and certainly one of the most evil, and that is not an offhand comment, E-V-I-L. But the very interesting thing between my sister and I is we have a common history with Hawaii, where my father was stationed from 1966 to 69. And it may well be at the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii that my sister was recruited into the ongoing treason she's been involved with, and some believe that she may be leading it, or one of the leaders. And I, not through any effort of my own or because of poor judgment, but just if you can call it coincidence if you wish, or chance, it's neither. But my relationship to 9/11 is threefold. The F-16s that were flying over the Pentagon on 9/11 were 3 of my peers. Actually, they're younger than me, but 3 people from the North Dakota Air National Guard who'd been launched in their F-16 ADF Viper models from Langley Air Force Base to respond to whatever it was that was bearing down on Washington. My sister, this is sickening, I'm actually the source, the academic source of the mode of the 9/11 attack, because my sister, who's a career bureaucrat and also a career traitor, was once in charge of the United States Marshal System airline, which some people call Conair, some people call it a variety of names, but basically the airline that was created to haul federal prisoners from Hawaii to the mainland, since there's no federal prison in Hawaii, and they didn't want to expose the airline passengers to these unpredictable felons. So my sister, in a conversation in December of 1988, once asked me, she said, Field, I have a problem. And I said, well, you know, you're working for the federal government. Surely they have the assets to solve your problem. She said, no, the problem is that I need to get prisoners from Hawaii to the mainland. And I said, well, that's no problem. We haul them on Northwest Airlines. And I know I forgot my biography, but at one point I spent 29 years at Northwest Airlines. And that was after and during. I had a 26-year career in the military, And just to get this in order for your listeners, I graduated from high school in Hawaii. My sister was forced to go to 1 year of University of Hawaii, and she hated it, but I think she was recruited there. But that's just my opinion, not a fact. Here's something that is a fact that every one of your listeners will find remarkable. When I was registered at Punahou School, and I was in the class of 1967, I was registered as Field McConnell Protestant, which means Christian to some, and United States citizen. There is a fellow named Barry Switero. Are you familiar with that name, James?
Do you mean the man commonly referred to as President Barack Obama?
Yes. Barry Switero graduated from Punahou School in 1979, so he's 12 years my junior. And when he was registered at Punahou School, he was registered as Barry Switero, Indonesian Muslim. When he graduated from there, he went to Occidental College in the Los Angeles basin, I believe, and he was registered as a he has a Fulbright scholarship, and of course, Fulbright scholarships are available only to foreign students. So the person that's in the White House that I fully intend to bring down, and I've got several tools which could do it. One of them is a wrongful death lawsuit, which I've been thinking about filing for about the last 120 days. The wrongful death, James, would be the 2,000 U.S. service personnel, and it's more than 2,000, but 2,000-plus cases of wrongful death for those illegally deployed to Afghanistan who have died since the 20th of January of 2009. And I'm not trying to talk down to you because I know that you're very well respected for your intellect. But do you remember what happened on the 20th of January of 2009, perhaps?
Was that inauguration?
Yes, it was. I thought I'm sort of like an attorney. I'll never ask you a question that I don't think you can answer because I don't think that's fair. But I thought you probably would. And do you remember there was a snafu on his oath taking? So Judge John Roberts claims that he administered it a second time in private?
Yes, I do.
Well, that's where they're sort of picking a stab with me because that's not good enough for me. I was in the military 26 years. Whoop-de-doo, who cares? But I was. And I took three oaths to the military, one to the Navy on some date in June of 67, one to the Marine Corps on some date in June of 71, and one to the Air Force on some date in July of 1977. And during all three of those oath-taking, I seriously volunteered to do whatever I could do in my power to defend the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That brings us to Barack Obama and my sister, Christine Marcy. He's a foreign enemy, and I'll get back to his second oath in a minute. My sister is a domestic enemy, and I have them both walked into a trap that neither one of them are intelligent enough to recognize as a trap. Here's the trap. Are you familiar with the recent media coverage of some missing Lois Lerner emails? And then, strangely, after the election in November, a lot of those emails were found. But what's even more remarkable, and here's where it focuses sort of on me in a favorable way from my perspective, there's 2,500 email addresses, and then therefore you can assume the emails themselves were turned over to the White House. Were you aware of that, James?
Not specifically, no.
Okay, well, I'll put that out to my chat room. Of course, they're not listening because they'll be listening when you put the MP3 out. But when I take a break and you're talking for any length of time, I'll try to get someone to post a link that I can read off to you. But yes, not Barry Switero, Punahou 79, but rather President Obama, who's never taken an oath to the United States of America that I'm aware of. But let me just stop with his second oath. His second oath would have been taken on January 20th of 2013. And do you know why that one was done in private, James?
I don't. I'm looking at the video of it right now.
Okay, well, I think if you check the calendar, and I wish that I had the chat room that I am supported by, I wish they could hear this because they'd pop up a link right away. But my recollection is that the law, the federal law, is that presidential inaugurations and the oath therein have to be sworn on the 20th of January. And by law also, if the 20th of January is on a weekend, then the oath is sworn during the weekend in private, and then the inauguration takes place on the first Monday after the weekend. And I believe, I think my recall is correct, that in 2013, his second inauguration took place on Monday, the 21st of January of 2013.
That is correct, yes.
Okay, well, see, I can't multitask. I don't know how old you are. You sound like you're probably late 40s, but I'm 65, and I don't want to focus on anything except what I'm trying to convey to you mentally, and I'm glad that you checked on that date. So neither one of his oaths have been publicly monitored, and in both cases, Judge Robert has told us, we the people, not just of the United States of America, but of the Western world, he's told everybody that, oh yes, he administered the oath twice to Barry Spatero or Barack Obama, or if you want to use the name he used between Barry Spatero and Barack Obama, that name is Barack, B-A-R-A-K, Monir, M-O-U-R-N-I-R, Ubaid, U-B-A-Y-D. So this man of many names suddenly has been our president, has gotten 2,000 or more people killed illegally in Afghanistan, and that is a case of wrongful death. And I guess you don't know much about me, and I'm not trying to overstate my case or pretend I'm anything other than an oath keeper, but I am not afraid at all of filing wrongful death charges on the president of the United States. Because I know how all of this is put together, and you may know from history that there was a guy named Danny Casolaro who was murdered in August of 1991 because he was about ready to expose something. Does that ring a bell at all, James?
Would that be the octopus?
Yeah, the octopus. Well, do you know who the octopus is? I mean, they think they're going to scare everybody. They're not scaring. I'm not scared. I hope I sound calm. I'm excited to be on your show and to have this opportunity to tell the truth. And let me just stop right there and identify myself. So if anybody wants to contact me and criticize me or correct me, they can do it efficiently. My name is F-I-E-L-D, Field McConnell, M-C-C-O-N-N-E-L-L. My email address is 8 letters, F-I-E-L-D-M-C-C at yahoo.com. And my phone number in the United States, my cell phone number, is 715-307-8222. So 23 years ago, Danny Casolaro was exposing Promise and exposing the octopus, and he ended up dying in a hotel room in Martinsburg, West Virginia. The octopus today, it can be found by Googling. If you do a web search for the biggest company or biggest corporation that most people have never heard of, it's Serco, S-E-R-C-O. Have you ever heard of Serco, James?
Only from your website and only recently.
Well, I tell you, I think you're doing the, and I'm absolutely 100% serious with this comment. It's not a hollow accolade. You know, you may be participating in getting this exposed or helping us get this exposed, or if you have a faith system that involves a higher power, helping that higher power expose the octopus. And the octopus is Serco. For your listeners who have never heard of Serco, I will spell it S-E-R-C-O. And if they want a two-minute education, go to YouTube and just put in Serco, the biggest company you never heard of. Serco has a direct link to Malaysia 370. Serco has a direct link to Malaysia 17. Serco had a direct link to 9/11. And MH370, as you'll recall, went down on the 8th of March of this year. What a long year it's been. 8th of March of 2014. And this will water your eyes, and you'd think I was bragging, except for I didn't do this. One of our Able Danger team members put out a YouTube that's 6 minutes long. He put it out on the 8th of March, the same day the airplane went down. It looks like he put it out on the 9th of March, but you alluded to earlier that we're on opposite sides of the international dateline, James, and that's why it shows up on as the 9th of March, because where it was published, the fellow was out of our country, and he was across. It was published, I believe, from the Philippines. What is remarkable about what he published is we told Malaysia, not only the government of Malaysia and Malaysian airline system, MAS, the operator of Malaysia Flight 370, we not only told them how their airplane was commandeered twice, once malevolently and once benevolently. The first commandeering, I believe with every shred of my fiber that Serco did it. The second commandeering, I believe, was done by good people in the United States Department of Defense. Those are just opinions. This will be exposed, you know, in a courtroom at some point. But the Dutch, the Ukrainians, perhaps the Malaysians, there's four countries, five counting Malaysia now, but they're having an investigation over there, but they're not very quick. We exposed exactly what happened the same day it happened, which was the 8th of March, in that YouTube. If any of your listeners want to see the six-minute YouTube, all they have to put in the search bar at YouTube is Boeing, B-O-E-I-N-G, uninterruptible, and I don't even think that's the correct word in English. I think if you spell check it, it'll come up red flagged, but it gets the point across. Uninterruptible autopilot. If your listeners or anybody else goes to YouTube and looks for Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, you can see exactly what we delivered to Malaysia the same day the airplane was lost. And some people in Malaysia got together after they looked at that YouTube, and they called me. And they called me in March, probably about 10 days after the event. And in the opening conversation, and I've always been fairly respectful of the people I went over and chatted with in Malaysia, and I'm going to continue that by not naming my contact over there. But I will tell you this. After coming back from Malaysia, where I spent 4 days, and the days I left Minneapolis for Amsterdam on the 15th of April, I arrived in Amsterdam, of course, the 16th, because fly all night. I left Amsterdam on the 16th of April, the same day, about 4 hours after I arrived, and I rode on, well, this is sort of eerie, but I rode on Malaysia Flight 17 from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur. So we'll just stop right there and say, notice that I rode on Malaysia 17, and notice that the next Malaysian airplane that got zapped was Malaysia 17, and that's probably just a coincidence. But when I got to Malaysia, it was actually the 17th. My host, I had a personal host who I've never identified, although many, many people can figure out who he or she was. But I've never identified the party. But I was there for 4 days on the ground, the 17th, 18th, 19th, and 20th. I met with at least four members of the government, and I'm going to be a little bit vague here on purpose, not to be dishonest, but just to protect some people that may be innocent or they may be guilty. But here it is, December 7th. Happy Pearl Harbor Day, by the way. December 7th, and I was over there April 17 to 20, and I'm still not sure if I was talking to good guys or bad guys, and that's one of the reasons why I never identify them by name, even though I know exactly who I was talking to. But I did also talk to a group of assembled experts, 11 to 15. I've published it so I could go Google myself and find out how many experts. But the night I left, which was the 20th of April of 2014, I was at a hotel about 2 miles from the airport, the Kuala Lumpur airport, and I was in a private conference room with recorders going and computers going, and I briefed the entire expert committee of Malaysian Airlines on how their aircraft was taken. And I can tell you, James, it's my opinion that everyone in the airline community appeared to be honest, and they appeared to believe everything I told them. Let me stop there and demonstrate one of the reasons why people tend to believe me. I'm going to use the word attacked, which is a little bit strong, but in my own chat room, there is a fellow, and I have a difficulty sometimes with names. And so I know exactly that your name's James Corbett, and I know that I'm Field McConnell, but we have different types of identities in our chat room, and there's a fellow in my chat room whose identity is NWAI, and he contacted me privately and said that I must be crazy because Boeing does not have an uninterruptible autopilot, or he'd know about it because of his position somewhere in the airline industry. Well, about, I'd say within 2 weeks of his telling me that the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot does not exist, I delivered to him a 66-page document of the patents of the Boeing Honeywell uninterruptible autopilot, and those patents start as early as 1952, and they run through 2013. And I can just tell you that the person who provided me all those patents is an insider of a large corporation, and he's sick about what his large corporation is being coerced or extorted into doing. And I will say also that there's members of the intelligence community in the United States of America that can't get the truth out without either getting a flatline EKG or losing a child or losing a grandchild. And so I'm frequently used as a vessel through which the truth can come. And I'll give you a couple of recent dramatic events. It's football season right now, and people that have nothing better to do than watch grown men beat each other up. The night, I think you might want to check a calendar while I tell you what day I think it was. I think on the 9th of November, it was a Sunday, and I think on that Sunday, the New York Jets were playing the Seattle Seahawks. And about 4 days prior to that football game, I got some recognizable good intelligence from someone in the United States military that suggested there was going to be, and it's more than a suggestion, there was, in fact, a military exercise in Seattle that was going to respond to, in an exercise fashion, they were going to respond to a nuclear event in Seattle. Well, I published that as a threat. Now, this is where some people really do think I'm either suicidal or nuts, and I'm neither. I published that on the front page of abledanger.net, and I published it as an ADTW, Able Danger Threat Window, and I put it out for the 9th of, if the 9th wasn't indeed Sunday, I put it out for that day based on intelligence that came to me from an insider in the Department of Defense who must have seen something bad on the horizon for Seattle. Well, nothing happened, and that's good, because that's why we publish things. We publish them very late, but before they can take the exercise live. Let me stop right there and tell all your listeners that what they saw on the morning of 9/11 was an exercise gone live. I would, if they're very interested in getting some details of the exercise, they can Google the name of the exercise. It was Amalgam. That's Alpha Mike Alpha Lima Golf Uniform Mike
Virgo VIGRGO.
Beautiful. So you've heard of that?
I certainly have. Yes.
Okay, that was an exercise that was practiced one time and one time only on the 1st and 2nd of June of 2001. One of my naval, I never finished my bio, did I? But you will do it backwards if we have to. I graduated from Annapolis in 1971. One of my college classmates was the three-star admiral who was responsible for changing the ROE, which is Rules of Engagement, for the North American Air Defense Command, which is NORAD. And the guy's name is Scott Fry. He's a retired three-star admiral. I found it odd that he would be changing the rules of engagement for aviation assets because he was a ship driver. In other words, the professional name in the Navy is surface warfare. But he drove ships. He didn't drive airplanes. But Serco and the... Well, let me stop here, and once again, this is not a test, but have you ever heard of the United States Senior Executive Service?
I can't say that name rings a bell, no.
Well, my sister created it. In 1978, Jimmy Carter asked my sister to create the United States Senior Executive Service, and so if you have a pencil or a pen, I want you to put it vertical. And what they did basically, if you take a look at the bottom of your pencil, you'll see lead, and at the top of your pencil, you'll see an eraser. What they did was they took every single U.S. bureaucracy, I'll pick three off the top of my head, Commerce, Department of Defense, and Treasury. They stuck civilians at the top of the chain of command of all those pencils. In other words, where the eraser used to be the highest you could go in any bureaucracy, overnight, with a stroke of my sister's pen, as authorized by President Carter, everybody that's a bureaucracy or a chain of command in our entire federal government got somebody on top of them. And that would be a very satisfying Google for you after we get off your show, if you just put in United States Senior Executive Service. And then if you want to do some more Googling, you can also add my sister's name, Christine Marcy. But it's absolutely criminal that our education system and our media in the United States of America don't come anywhere close to the truth. And here I sit as a private citizen exposing my only sibling for being one of the most heavily entrenched architects of treason. And the goal is quite simple, to end the United States of America as we know it. And I think they've gotten fairly close. I think they're going to fail. But, and this is going to sound, once again, as either someone who may have a mental problem or somebody who's nuts. But I frankly would rather be dead than be quiet. And when I started talking, I spent a career at Northwest Airlines, and after 29 years of never having a problem with an airplane that I couldn't solve, and never failing a check ride, and never having an incident, I had incidents, but none of them resulted in injuries or aircraft being damaged. After 29 years, when I started being rather vocal about my view of 9/11, and let me stop right there and say, besides the fact my sister took my intellectual property and turned that into the drone, in other words, the converted airliners that were flown as drones on 9/11, I'm the intellectual source of that, and my sister got that information from me. And then you may be familiar with this name, Hillary Clinton of Rose Law.
It rings a bell. Yeah, it might just was that an insult, or are you being serious?
No, Hillary Clinton and my sister are both products of Georgetown, and Georgetown University is where the Society of Jesus, or you might know them as Jesuits, that appears to be their U.S.-based headquarters. And Georgetown has been educating some really bad people for a really long amount, you know, for a long, long time, probably since 1789. For some reason, I think they started in 1789, but that's neither here nor there. But Hillary Clinton and my sister got my little idea about droning, and Hillary Clinton was at Rose Law at the time, and one of the intellectual property patents that came across her desk was from a corporation that was then named BEI, and it was the triaxial, I'm going to give you some nomenclature, don't write it down, you can email me later, but it was called the QRS, Quebec Romeo Sierra 11, QRS 11, which was a solid-state gyroscope that was essential for controlling Raytheon supersonic missiles. Well, they took that technology and they put it in a bunch of Boeing drones. And what, regardless of what people think they saw on 9/11, and I'm being specific to the people who think they saw American 11 hit the second tower, American 11 hit the first tower, United 175 hit the second tower, and people, there were some live eyewitnesses who think they saw an American airplane strike the Pentagon. They saw things, but they didn't see American 11, they didn't see United 175, and they didn't see American 77, which brings us to the third connection I have to 9/11, which I could not, if I wanted to, I could not control these coincidences. My sister helped design it. My Air National Guard unit and the F-16s helped, cause it to fail ultimately. If the fourth aircraft hit the fourth target, we wouldn't be having this conversation right now, I believe. But the third connection I have to 9/11, which is beyond my control and beyond my sister's control, is the captain of American 77, which did not hit the Pentagon. His name is Francis Charles Burlingame, and Chick Burlingame is what he was known by. And his specialty, after he got out of my Naval Academy class of 1971, he was a Navy fighter pilot, and he was very good at what he did, and he went to Top Gun school. But then when he started his American Airlines career, he transferred to the reserves, and his, you know, Hollywood writers can't write this kind of stuff, but his specialty or his job at the Pentagon, where he was a reserve Navy captain, was he was in charge of military war gaming, and he came up with a plan where air-breathing flying vehicles, manned or unmanned, would attack iconic buildings in the United States of America. And then on 9/11, he was sitting in American 77 when it was destroyed with malice and discretion aforethought by the United States Senior Executive Service and Circle, and the location where his airplane was vaporized, and I'll explain vaporized as a correct word in a minute. It was in a military airspace called Whiskey 386 Alpha, which is about 60 miles straight east of Norfolk. And at Norfolk, they have the Navy trains their fighter pilots there at Naval Air Station Oceana. The Air Force has, I think, the very first operational squadron with the F-22 is right there at the Air Force Base, which is Langley. And on that morning of 9/11, it was my Air National Guard unit from Fargo, North Dakota, the 178th Fighter Squadron, who had the alert duty. So on the morning of 9/11, you've got three of my peers trying to chase down American 77 and or United 93. And when I used both American 77 and United 93, here's why. The three F-16s took off at 0932 from Langley, and they were immediately vectored out to Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace. The controller of Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace on the morning of 9/11 was a military call sign. And once again, Hollywood can't write this stuff. The call sign was Giant Killer. Giant Killer would not allow the three F-16s, I'll give you their call signs, Quit 25, Quit 26, and Quit 27, Q-U-I-T. The Quit flight of three F-16s was then turned directly towards Washington, D.C., where they went as fast as they probably could, and that would be about 1,200 miles an hour in an F-16, directly towards the Pentagon. But they arrived at the Pentagon after the flying vehicle, and I saw something. I don't have much time to research people, but I did see something that someone sent me, and they attribute it to you. And ultimately, I'm not sure if it was you or not, but whoever it was that I watched a very short YouTube of today discussed how the flying vehicle that attacked the Pentagon did a right 270-degree spiral attack. Is that words you ever would have uttered?
A 270-degree corkscrew turn coming down level with the Pentagon?
Yeah, so you've heard
descending
that
8,000 feet, yes.
Yes, that's exactly right. Then it was your voice. Okay, well, that's impossible for a transport category aircraft to do that. And the reason I think that the Senior Executive Service needed to get the three F-16s delayed by sending them out on a wild goose chase to Whiskey 386 Alpha is if those three air defense pilots had with their own eyeballs and their own 35 millimeter or their own digital cameras, and they would have both, they would have not only seen and recognized what flew into the Pentagon, but they hopefully would have been positioned to destroy it. And I do have an opinion of what it was that hit the Pentagon, but I can tell you, because I'd rather deal with facts than opinions, I can tell you 100% certain it was not a Boeing 757. And the reason I know that is sometimes because of what I know, it appears I'm egotistical. Well, let me address that right now. I wouldn't know what I know if I hadn't been supported by a higher power in being in the positions I never should have been in the first place. I should not have gotten into the Naval Academy. I should not have graduated. I should not have had good enough flying scores to get to be a jet pilot, but I did. And with my personality, which some find offensive, I probably never should have lasted 26 years in the military, but I did. And I'm in a position of having my college classmate, Chick Burlingame, murdered. I'll say that again, murdered on the morning of 9/11. My sister, Christine Marcy, part of the evil cabal that arranged for some people to be murdered in Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace, which reminds me, I got to go back and explain Vaporize. Vaporize is the method by which these three airliners, and when I say three airliners, American 11, American 175, and American 77, all three were vaporized in Whiskey 386 Alpha Airspace while their drone replacements basically provided eye candy for a bunch of Americans who were going to be misled into thinking 23 young men who couldn't fly a Cessna could somehow hit targets that were great, iconic buildings. And I'll stop right here, James, so you can either control me, slow me, speed me, turn me, but the stuff I'm telling you right now, I've put in writing over the last 7 or 8 years, and I have not been sued for libel. And the reason I have not been sued for libel is what I'm telling you is 100% true. Do you have any questions right now at this point, James?
Well, I must admit I'm a bit flummoxed. I have about 3.5 million questions because I must admit I've never had a guest introduce himself for 40 minutes before, which is the entirety of the time I had allotted for the interview. So I don't know how to proceed from this point because you threw out enough information that I, again, there's hundreds of pieces of details there that you just threw out that some of which I understand independently, Whiskey 386 and things of that nature, which I'd already been familiar with, others which I am just becoming familiar with, such as Serco. So I wouldn't even know how to begin proceeding with this conversation as an interviewer, which presents something of a problem, I would say. I think at this point, I have a couple of questions specifically on a couple of things that you said, but I'm going to actually call on the Corbett Report research community to start using this the post for this interview as a research resource for the types of information that you were just providing there, and to see how much of this we can independently source and vet and pull up with independent documents. But I will ask, I had originally believed this interview was going to be about the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot. I'm apparently incorrect in that assumption, but on that note, you did mention that. You did, of course, mention the idea that uninterruptible is not even proper English. This raises the question of where this name comes from. Is this a term that you have given to this system, or is this something that comes from the documents themselves?
No, I did not name it that, but what I'll do, as soon as we hang up, I'll send you the 66-page document of the patents. But they created a system. It's supposed to be a safety enhancement for all airliners. Airbus airliners started employing the Airbus uninterruptible autopilot in 1989 as factory equipment. Boeing started putting them in 1995 in their aircraft, and the Boeing 777 that crashed on Malaysia Flight 370 had one of these autopilots. And I'll tell you the ostensible and safety-related positive reason to develop the uninterruptible autopilot. Back 15 or 20 years ago, before 9/11, we had humans trying to hijack airplanes. And to counter that, they determined that the software of the aircraft could be modified, and the hardware, so that if any human tried to take over an aircraft, that a button could be pushed in the cockpit by one of the two or three pilots. And once that button was pushed, nothing in the cockpit would work, and the airplane itself would continue on its flight plan under remote control. And that autopilot feature had to be uninterruptible. And that's because, you know, from an airline pilot standpoint, you wouldn't want the software and hardware to be overridden by a human. So that would work out real well with airline pilots if they only knew about it. But until I started talking about the Boeing uninterruptible autopilot, No airline pilots anywhere in the world had ever heard of it, unless they were in Germany. Lufthansa, which is an excellent airline, discovered the uninterruptible autopilots in the late 90s. And I would bet my eye teeth that El Al, the Israeli airline, I bet they know all about it. But the airlines that know about it today include Malaysia, because I told them, and Emirates. And Emirates over in UAE, United Arab Emirates, the CEO of Emirates Airlines came out in June of this year, and he was being somewhat critical of Malaysia and Malaysia Airlines by saying that their airplane's been gone for 90 days and they haven't discovered where it went. Well, I corrected, the CEO's name is Tim Clark, and if anybody wants to see how I corrected him, it would look rather unprofessional to some people, but see, I'm still alive, and that's been my goal all along, is to not create an early funeral for myself just by being truthful. But there's a YouTube out there that came out in late June of this year, and it's called Attention CEO Tim Clark, 5 Critical Questions. And that's probably an 8-minute, I don't know, maybe it's a 10-minute YouTube, but that got the attention of CEO Tim Clark, who started quoting Abel Danger or quoting Field McConnell. And I'm not trying to gain anything. I'm also trying not to lose any more than I have. But it's my obligation, as I mentioned when you welcomed me to your show, it's my obligation to communicate openly with the truth. And I don't think you're going to find, well, the fact that I haven't been sued for libel in 8 years, that's pretty profound. And it's not like these people don't know what I'm doing, because my manner of communicating, and you may have seen that today with the confusing emails, if you go back to those confusing emails and take a look at who they went to the Milwaukee FBI, who I happen to favor. They went to Serco Corporation, because I'm taking the fight right to them. Oh, let me stop there and tell you one of the ways we know we're getting our message out. Serco, the company that you never heard about 2 hours ago, on the 6th of November, their stock took about a 31 to 35% plunge in one day. That's because we are exposing Serco, and to use a term that you're familiar with for the past 23 years, Serco is indeed the octopus, and we intend to gaff the octopus. And the very unique position I'm in, where I'm one of the 2,500 email addresses and emails that were delivered to the White House from the IRS, I've just got 1, 2, 3 claims from the IRS with specific information that only one person in the world other than me would have. And that is my sister, because my sister and I are co-trustees for some resources that my parents left for 7 grandchildren. But there's not one human on earth other than my sister that would know the financial details of what now the IRS knows. So I'm just assuming that my sister is trying to protect Barry Swatero, because she, in fact, created him. At one point, she was telling the U.S. Passport Office what to do. And in the same year, 1996, well, let me back up and say 1996 is a watershed year because of what happened on the 22nd of October in the United States Department of Justice that involved my sister, Jamie Gorelick, and Janet Reno. But that's for another show or another email. But on the 22nd of October of 1996, the shadow government stood up and basically patted themselves on the back for reinventing government. Well, my sister is not smart enough to reinvent government, but the founding fathers were quite wise, and they established a government that has worked relatively well over the last 3 centuries. And if my sister's going to continue and try to prevail in destroying the United States of America, frankly, she's going to have to find some way of destroying me, and I don't think she can do it. James, over to you.
Well, I once again, I don't know really what to say, because there's a mind-boggling amount of information that you've just presented that I think we'll have to go over. And generally, I would present the show notes for the audience, in which would have links to all of the things discussed, but I don't think that would be physically, humanly possible for me to do by myself. So once again, I'm going to ask the listeners out there, if you're interested in the information that's been presented here today, let's start compiling this information and putting some of the links together to vet what you've just put out on the table. And I guess the logical starting point would be the 66-page patent documents that you just referred to earlier. I assume that's already available on your website.
Yeah, I'm sure that. See, I don't even go to my own website because I'm too busy doing stuff that's developing. But yes, the abledanger.net website has a search window or a search box up in the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. And I think if somebody put in 66 page document, it may come up, but I've already written it down on my shopping list of what to email to you immediately after we hang up on each other.
Okay, and that was abledanger.net?
Yes, .net, not .com. And it's very important that they put in, they spell Abel correctly, like Abel and Cain in the Bible.
Right.
It's abeldanger.net.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, that of course will be linked up in the show notes for the interview. And as I say, we'll use the comment section of this interview to start putting some of the pieces of this puzzle together. I don't really know what to say other than thank you for your time. I mean, this has been an incredible amount of data that we're going to have to start putting together here. And again, I think we'll just have to take it from here and start connecting some of these dots. So Field McConnell, thank you so much for your time today.
And James Corbett, thank you very much for having me, and I will be emailing you within 120 seconds.
All right, sounds good. I look forward to it.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night.